Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, December 19th, day number 353 of 2013. We're 1 week away from Christmas, actually less than a week, 6 days away from Christmas. So tonight we thought we'd mix it up. We have war stories and Christmas. And what better two people to join us than Leslie Eastman and Barry Jacobson. And tonight we're going to go back and remember what it was like, what Christmas time was like during time of war. We'll be looking at World War One. We'll be looking at World War Two. We're even going to Vietnam. So we've got a few stories that we're going to share with you tonight as we mix Christmas and war stories. And our good friend Barry Jacobson, our military historian, is joining us. And, of course, Leslie always joins us on Thursday night. Just a quick plug, you know, we're running out of time, but you still may have a few days to go to the Amazon and get yourself a copy of my book, Cubanos in Wisconsin. You can get it print, you can get it Kindle, and I think Amazon can get it to you in a couple of days. I'm pretty sure they have that option. Or you can request it from our website. And if you live here in the Dallas area, I promise I'll deliver the book to you. I'll deliver a dedicated copy of the book to you. So CubanosinWisconsin.com, get yourself a copy and give it to someone you love, someone you know, on Christmas time. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Leslie right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let me say Merry Christmas to Leslie Eastman. Merry Christmas, Leslie.
Well, Merry Christmas, Silvio, and hope it's starting to be a festive season for you and your family.
It's starting to. You know, we're usually a late-arriving family. We're not, we don't get into it the Friday after Thanksgiving like the radio stations wish we would, but we usually, it starts a little bit later for us, and it could also be the Latin American Spanish tradition where, you know, the Christmas starts a little bit later but actually goes a little bit longer into the 6th of January, which is when I grew up getting gifts, you know. That was the day that the three wise men would bring us gifts when we were little boys and girls. So for us it starts a little bit later, but it also goes a little bit longer. What about for your family, Leslie?
Well, my boys are off to Australia, so we celebrated family Christmas this past Saturday. So, we pretty much are done at this point, and I'm just looking forward to some peace and quiet and sharing some good history with you tonight.
Absolutely, and that exactly we are going to do tonight. We have Barry's going to be joining us in a minute with some military stories, but I've got to begin before Barry joins us. I've got to begin with this story, and it is not about our show, but it is what everybody's talking about in the country. And this is this program, television program, that, by the way, I don't watch, but called Duck Dynasty. I guess that's the name of the program. And there's all kinds of outrage about it. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, let's set it up, Silvio. For those listeners that we have who may not be fans, Duck Dynasty is a look at a family, I think, that built their fortune on duct tape. And they're very, you know, fundamentalist Christian rural types from the South. So when the bigwigs at A&E decided to focus on this particular family as part of reality TV effort, I'm sure it was in mind to kind of send a mocking attitude. But what it didn't count on is how much the family and its dynamics captured the imagination. And it's the most successful cable reality show on the history of TV. So bonus for the creative minds at A&E for taking a risk. But it seems that despite the fact that they knew how very opinionated the head of the family, Phil Roberts, was, and that he's very much, you know, Bible-thumping when it comes to his personal beliefs and very inclined to share them, when he got interviewed with GQ magazine for whatever fashion aspect that the GQers were interested in, he shared his opinions very graphically about what he saw of the relationship status between two men. And it seems that in a rush to quash what they feared would be backlash from gay activists, A&E put him on indefinite suspension. However, they seem to be reversing themselves because there has been an outcry of support for what happened, and I think people are really concerned about the First Amendment issues at hand.
That's right. Well, again, in the interest of full disclosure, I do not watch the show. I had no idea. I mean, I had heard about it. I knew that it was very successful, but I did not watch the show. And I was always a bit puzzled by the beard because I thought it was a show from Alaska, you know, where they have, you know, where men tend to wear beards like that. I mean, I said, my gosh, you know, beards like that in the Louisiana humidity, that's got to be pretty rough. But anyway, it is a very successful show. And for some reason, a lot of people want you know, really went nuts with what he said. And you know what, Leslie, we're entitled to our own opinion. If you don't like the show, don't watch it. That's my feeling. There's a lot of stuff that I don't watch. I don't watch MSNBC because I don't like what they do. I don't like to listen to a lot of rap music because I don't like the way they sing about women, for example. So I just don't watch it. I just don't listen to it. And I wish some of these people who are constantly lecturing us would simply use that little instrument that changes the channel and stay out of our lives. You know, if we want to watch Duck Dynasty, let us watch it. If they don't want to watch it, well, they can watch whatever they want to watch, Leslie.
Well, yeah, I'm of a different mind. A&E is within its rights to do whatever it wants with whatever show it wants to present. You know, it's heartening to know that the man was able to give an opinion and still his show seems to be on the air and they seem to be going forward. And what I find interesting is that it's not all the gay people who were necessarily against this. And I'd like to encourage people to read in Time a piece by a gay writer, Brandon Rosino, who says that the whole fiasco says more about the bigotry of the gays toward rural Southern people than it does about Phil Roberts' own bigotry. And it's kind of, he views it as a chance to start a dialogue to educate. And people have very strong opinions. But one thing, if you go back and listen or catch the entire interview, Roberts doesn't present this as he hates all gays. And in the context, he was very, this is what I believe, you don't have to believe it, and he was very clear to say he would respect people, you know, no matter what their particular lifestyle choices were. He just didn't happen to share them. And what
right.
more could you possibly want?
Absolutely, absolutely. And as I said, I did not watch the interview where he said these things, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of catching up reading what he said, but what – as I understand what he said, Leslie, was he was talking about sin, not just homosexuality. He was talking about sin, and he spoke about other types of sin, not just, you know, what he views homosexuality as a sin. And I just think the reaction from the gay community, I think that a little bit over the top, I think, their reaction. And they imagine, I don't know what's going to happen to the program. I understand that the family is angry about what happened to their father or grandfather. They may end up going to another network, and A&E could very well lose maybe their biggest source of revenue, Leslie.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's not all gay people, as demonstrated by the gay writer who is on that kind of views things similar to the way we view it. However, it's a very aggressive gay activist who have actually caused a needless disruption and a needless controversy that does nothing to further their cause of tolerance. So I think there's a lot of good lessons to be learned here from people if they care to actually learn them. And
right.
Like I said, it'll be interesting to see what happens with A&E, because it's one thing, I don't watch the program, but I'll tell you what, if an A&E program comes on that I might normally have wanted to view, I'm going to think twice before I actually flip the channel now, because I want people who are like this Phil Roberts to be able to express their opinion, and even if it was graphic, it wasn't hateful. And I think, you know, that they rushed to judgment and caused a lot of, you know, needless bad feelings to brew. Says a lot about the A&E executives, and I don't think I want to promote their work necessarily. So I'm going to really have to think twice before flipping to that channel in the future.
Well, I think you and lots of people, Leslie, are probably thinking that way. I mean, as I said, it's not a channel that I watch or a network that I watch, although I must confess when cable first came into existence back in whenever it was in the late 80s or mid-90s or whatever, when this channel came in, they used to do a lot of very good programming. They would show a lot of these British shows, historical shows that you tend to see on PBS, and they used to show a lot of that at A&E, but recently they've gone in different directions. I don't really watch the network. I don't watch this show, but I do think people are entitled to express their opinions, and we shouldn't be coming down on... I mean, I don't call for the elimination of networks that I don't like, or the elimination of shows that I don't like. I simply express myself, as I mentioned before, Leslie, by not watching it or by not buying the CD or the DVD or whatever. That's how I express myself in the marketplace. I don't shut people down. I just don't buy what they're peddling. But let's talk a little bit about tonight as we wait for Barry to check in with us. What we're doing tonight is that we're telling war stories in the context of Christmas. Did I lose you, Leslie?
Yeah, briefly. I think
okay.
We have a slight technical glitch.
I think you'll find
Mr. Jacobson will be dialing in shortly.
Okay, good. All right, no problem. I knew your magic would work. But but I think what we're going to do tonight, is we're going to bring Christmas and war stories to the same page, because obviously when you're fighting a war, you know, you fight the war during Christmas time as much as you do in the summer or any other time of the year. And I think tonight we're going to mix this up. And you wrote a post about this. Some of the chapters that we're going to cover are the Battle of the Bulge in 1944 Christmas. We're going to be talking about World War One, and I think we've got our friend Barry on the phone. Hi, Barry.
Sorry to be so late. I had some technical difficulties with my phone.
Well, no problem. That's okay. Leslie and I were doing a little Duck Dynasty talking, so let me give you 30 seconds and give me your opinion on that.
Well, I think it's, for me, it's a freedom of speech issue. I don't necessarily agree with the way he expressed himself, but he certainly should have a right to express himself as he wishes. Yeah, just because the guy has a television show, by the way, a hit television show, making a lot of money for A&E, I don't think he should be prohibited from saying what he believes, which apparently is scriptural. I mean, it was his religious beliefs. So, I think that's a problem, that we've gotten to the point where you can't express yourself honestly without fear of some kind of sanction if you don't agree with the left-wing thought police. So that's my take on it.
No, that's exactly right. You're exactly right. You're exactly right about that. Well, let's get into our topic tonight. We have a great combination tonight of war stories that you've done so well in previous shows, and the season of Christmas. And I know we've got some that we've selected, Leslie, so let me give it to Leslie right now. Leslie, which one are we going to do first?
Well, I was thinking Barry would lead us in the discussion on an event that actually happened today regarding the German leadership. So, Barry, why don't you take it away?
Well, yes, this is the anniversary, the 19th of December, of when Adolf Hitler took personal command of the Axis forces. Up until then, he had been, of course, the Führer of Germany, but the German armed forces and the war effort were being directed by a general staff, the German general staff, which was, by the way, the most professional German staff in the world. And after many reverses, particularly Stalingrad and El Alamein, he decided to take personal command and essentially override his generals. And everything that went wrong with Germany from that point on can be kind of traced to that decision, though he had interfered, you know, plenty before that. But the great decisions, the great bad decisions by Germany that lost in that war were largely attributable to Adolf Hitler. And so, in some ways, I guess today is a great day because that hastened the end of World War II in the sense that it greatly hastened Germany's defeat.
So you're talking 1942, right? You're talking 1942. So this would have been right after Stalingrad, I take it, right?
It was in the midst of Stalingrad. It was during the Stalingrad battle. And if you remember, a little bit earlier in December, actually end of November, Marshal Zhukov had launched Operation Uranus, which was the Soviet counterattack. That ended up surrounding von Paulus's Sixth Army at Stalingrad and turning the tables. Up until then, the Germans had been on the offensive, and at that point they became defenders. They were surrounded and defending themselves at Stalingrad. So that was in November of 42, and of course in November of 42 also was the defeat at El Alamein by the British under Field Marshal Montgomery. So in December, 19th of December, Hitler thought he would solve the problem by declaring himself the taking personal command of the army. And he set up his own headquarters, OKW, over command of Wehrmacht, which means German Armed Forces. And it was a counter headquarters to OKH, which was overall command of the army. Or the Heer, the army, OKH. So the German general staff, the most professional general staff in the world, was now superseded by Hitler, who had no more experience at staff position than a corporal in World War I, and a handful of pet generals who were nothing more than yes men, lackeys.
Barry, let me ask you a question about the timing of this. Was this before or after the attempted assassination of Hitler, you know, when that bomb, I don't remember the name of the incident, but you know which one I'm talking about, when there was a bomb, and they made a movie recently about it, where the bomb went off, but Hitler was not in the place, I guess. Was this after or before that?
This is 2 years before. That you're thinking of Valkyrie, which is the operational name of the incident.
Right. So this is 2 years. That would have been in 44. The attempted assassination.
Yeah, that was July of 44. So this is December 42. It's somewhat earlier.
Okay.
And of course, in Valkyrie was von Stauffenberg, was the one-eyed, one-armed general, actually Colonel von Stauffenberg, who was the guy carrying the bomb. He carried it into Wolf's Lair, which is Hitler's headquarters in East Prussia. And placed it underneath the table and then left. And Hitler was standing there, but the bomb was in the satchel was then taken by another officer who had accidentally kicked it over. And that other officer then moved it out of the way behind a table leg. And this table leg was a very thick wooden table leg. And when the bomb went off, it absorbed most of the shock and actually shielded Hitler. So while it killed a lot of other men in the room, unfortunately, Hitler survived.
Yeah. Now, one more question about this change, Hitler taking over. I'm assuming that most of the very, and I think you mentioned this, most of the very professional German military, and they had some of the best generals and military minds of the century, I would assume most of them thought this was a pretty bad idea by the Führer.
Yes, they did. And really from 1941 on, there is a constant turnover of generals as Hitler fires one after another and relieves his supreme command. The commanders who had actually won the first couple years. The ones responsible for Blitzkrieg that overruns all of Europe in 1939-1940 are mostly fired at the end of 41. These are men like Guderian, for instance, the father of Blitzkrieg, and Walther von Blachwitz, who's the supreme commander, and later on Halder, General Halder. All these men are fired and replaced by yes men. So by 1944, you have this large cadre of fired generals and ex-officers who are forcibly retired, you know, from positions of power, who have been disagreeing with Hitler all along and eventually rise up against him and form this conspiracy, which becomes known as Valkyrie.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent explanation. So which one is next, Leslie?
Well, that kind of leads us into the next big World War II December event, the Battle of the Bulge. And actually, Barry and I were chatting about this yesterday, and what I found it fascinating was the difference in numbers of the Germans on their Eastern Front versus the Western Front. So maybe you can set up what the two battlegrounds looked like in 1944, just before the Battle of the Bulge.
Well, yes. It's important to remember that in 1941, Hitler invades Russia, and many would say that was the biggest mistake of his career, in that he completely underestimated just how immense geographically Russia was and how resilient the Russian military was, what the reserves of troops and equipment really was. So from 41 on, from June of 41 when he launches the invasion of Russia until 1944, June of 1944 when the Allies land in Normandy, most of Hitler's attention is devoted to the Eastern Front. Yes, he is fighting in North Africa against Montgomery, where Field Marshal Rommel and the Africa Corps are fighting the West. But that's one corps. That's basically three divisions of German troops. He's got several hundred divisions of German troops, including his very best formations like the Waffen-SS and Panzer Grenadier Division Grossdeutschland. These are the elite divisions of the German army. And they're all concentrated on the Eastern Front in a death struggle with the Russians. And really from 42 on, from the Battle of Stalingrad on, they're no longer on the offensive, they're on the defensive. And they've literally got a tiger by the tail. When we land in Sicily and in Italy and Normandy, Hitler really, this gives you kind of an idea of how strong the Third Reich really was. Hitler was able to keep us occupied with really second echelon units. There were very few elite units on the Western Front. Most of his forces were concentrated in Russia. And to give you an idea, in Normandy we had all of the American and all the British troops that weren't occupied in Italy with Mark Clark's offensive in Italy were landing in Normandy. And Hitler had basically only three of his main Panzer divisions facing us. The Panzerlehr Division, which means the Panzer Training Division, and he had the 1st SS Panzer Corps, or the 1st SS Panzer Division, which was the Hitler Life Guard Division, you know, the very elite of the SS, and their sister unit, the Hitler Jugend, or Hitler Youth Division. which was a spinoff division of that first unit. Those only three, that and the 21st Panzer were the only, four top units we were facing. And they retreated through Europe all the way to the German border throughout 44. And we thought the war was done. We thought 1944, the Americans, the Allies, the British, we really thought by 1944 the Germans were finished. They had been retreating since Normandy. We'd pushed them all the way back to the German border. And the situation leading up to the Battle of Bulge was that if you think of the Western Front, you have basically open terrain in between the Swiss border and the Ardennes Forest, where Patton's Third Army is knocking on the door of the Saar, which is in Alsace-Lorraine. It's opposite the Rhine River between Metz and Strasbourg. And that's called the Saar region of Germany on the other side of the Rhine River. Patton was about to attack into the Saar with the American Third Army. And then north of the Ardennes Forest in Belgium and southern Holland was Montgomery, along with the First Army. And they were facing the Germans in the northern part of Germany on the Rhine River border. And in between those two forces was the Ardennes Forest. And this is a mountainous region which was considered, stupidly, as it turned out, to be impassable to armor. And so we are basically resting tired units and depleted units there in the Ardennes, in that central section of the front, and letting them rest, thinking that would be a quiet sector. Now, we should have known better because in 1940, the Germans had used the Ardennes Forest as the main pivot point, the main focal point of their attack into France by Guderian and his panzers, that had conquered France in 1940 in 6 weeks. And they'd used the Ardennes Forest as the way to split the French and the British in two. So we should have known the Germans knew that they could use panzers to the Ardennes, and yet we seem to have forgotten that or ignored it. So in December of 1944, the Americans are thinking the Germans are finished, and that's when the Germans launch the first and really the only major offensive against the Allies, and that's the Battle of the Bulge.
What was its objective?
Yeah, that's right. Good question, Leslie.
What did they think to accomplish, given how challenging everything had been up to this time?
Okay, well, first of all, there's two factors to keep in mind. First is that the Germans are developing what they think are super weapons, but they need more time. The first of these super weapons is, of course, the atomic bomb. The Germans were working on an atomic bomb at the same time we were. As it turned out, Hitler's appraisals were optimistic. He probably would not have gotten an atomic bomb in time, even if they had won the Battle of the Bulge. But they're working on that. They're also working on V2 rockets. These are basically prototype for later rockets, the kind we send capsules into space in. But the advantage of the V2 rocket was, unlike the earlier rockets, they could range from Germany and hit the United States, at least in theory. They certainly could hit anywhere in Britain. And finally, they're working on jet aircraft. They already developed the prototypes and were starting to mass produce jet fighters that, in theory, could regain Germany air dominance over the battlefield, which they had lost 2 years earlier after the Battle of Britain, at least began to lose it. And that was their biggest problem on the Western Front, was that the Allies had enormous air superiority. So unlike on the Russian front, where they can mass armored forces and fight a mobile battle, a panzer battle, a tank battle, and always defeat larger Russian forces with more adroit and more nimble German panzer forces. In the West, they couldn't do that. They couldn't mass armor in any strength without American or British air power just destroying it from the air, very much like the Americans did against the Iraqis during Desert Storm. So in 1944, in December, there was a weather front coming down that would ground American aircraft. So what Hitler and his generals planned to do was launch a major offensive by stripping the Eastern Front of some of its best formations, concentrating some of these elite units that hadn't been seen in the West before, and launching a major offensive through the Ardennes Force, whose purpose was to drive all the way to the sea and cut the Americans and British in two. split the forces in Belgium from the forces in the south in the Alsace-Lorraine region, and capture the vital port of Antwerp.
Mm. Now, and these were very optimistic reports that he, or very optimistic thoughts that Hitler had, Barry, right? I mean, was this Hitler thinking that he could do this, or was he getting these reports from his generals?
A bit of both. Keep in mind that his generals most had been replaced by yes men, who were more sensitive to Hitler's psyche and pleasing the Führer and the way he saw things than they were on telling him the truth, you know, and speaking truth to power. But that said, your real question is, was the Battle of Bulge plausible? Could the Germans have won it? And the answer is probably not. And the reason was because the Achilles heel of the German army at this point in the war was lack of fuel.
Right.
They were so short of fuel that they had enough fuel to sustain operations without any help for no more than a couple days of all-out warfare. And then they had to capture American supplies of fuel to keep the panzers moving. So their plan actually called for them to drive forward and actually capture as they advanced, and they were going to use the element of surprise to do this, and we'll talk about some other things they had in mind, some special operations.
Right. Well, Barry, if we could just take a quick break, and we'll get back to the Battle of Bulge. I know there's a couple of other things that we want to talk about. I want to say hello to our good friend Aaron Clary up in Minnesota. Merry Christmas, Aaron. How you been up there?
I'm doing good. Did you guys hear me, and did you switch me over?
No, you're on.
Oh, I'm on. Good. Yeah, no, things are going great. We went through a two-week spell of zero to below zero weather, and so we hunkered down with our Scandinavian girlfriend. We stayed warm, and now it's above zero, and it's wonderful. It was 35 degrees yesterday. I even did a video outside, so I'm very thankful for the warm weather.
All right. Tell us about this new book that apparently is ready, right?
It's ready, yeah. It's. I have my lawyer looking at the legal section. There was one chapter about legal advice, basically, and she wanted to take a look at it, and knowing it's wise to, you know, measure twice, cut once, I said, okay, well, let's take a look at that. So she's looking at that, and then my buddy Jorge Gonzalez, he is putting together the cover for the book. So the book has been written. It's just these minor, you know, editorial type technicalities and details that have to be done, but you got to be, you know, it's got to be done right, but it should be available by next week. So it's going to be, maybe, I don't know, Santa will be able to read it to his elves as he's flying across the North Pole.
That's right. And with all the technology we have right now, Santa can get it to you pretty quickly. Say hello to Leslie.
Hello, Leslie. How are you?
Great. Happy to hear that you've recovered from your illness, despite the fact I ignored you.
Well, no. You never ignored me, my dear. I actually ran 3 miles today, and I don't feel too bad. So I didn't want to push it and relapse, but yes, I'm staying in shape for all the Leslie Eastmans out there so that I may remain sexy and attractive to the opposite sex.
Well, I was going to say, did the video of the dancing girl I sent help in your recovery at all?
It did. Yes, thank you, because you're one of the few girls that gave me any kind of pampering when I was sick, and I didn't get any other kind of pampering from any other women. So that did help me in my time of need. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm always happy to help one of my capitalist heroes.
Aaron, tell us about Captain Capitalism and how people can get the book.
Well, okay, Captain Capitalism is my website, captaincapitalism.blogspot.com. We got daily tomfoolery going on, basically of the economic variety and maybe a little bit of the dating and social variety. But then there's also the podcast, and then there is the various books that I have written. The most recent one coming out is Bachelor Pad Economics. So that's going to be coming out recently within the next week. And then there is also, of course, kind of the standard bearers. There's Worthless. And then there's also the book called Enjoy the Decline. And so, you want to come hang out and talk economics and, shoot the blathering, you may. Just go to captaincapitalism.blogspot.com, and there's always something going on at my website.
Well, you know, I keep sending you articles, and I'll just say one last thing here, but I keep sending you articles about college education and college students. It's obvious that your book The timing of your message was absolutely great, and many of the ideas that you put out there are having an influence on young people.
It is, yeah. I'm getting emails every day from people. I don't say this to sound like I'm bragging. I'm just saying because we are making a difference, and you have no idea. It means more to me than the money I make when I hear some young kid saying, like, hey, you changed my life. You sent me down the right path. But then, Sylvio, you send me these articles. Some are good, and then some are like, really? These people didn't realize it? So, yeah, there's still a lot of work left to do because you still got these people thinking they can literally get a master's degree in puppetry and survive. So I think the market for that book is not going away anytime soon. But I would trade all the sales in the world just to have these young kids realize just kind of what a risk they're taking when they go and major in a worthless degree.
That's exactly right. Well, I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas. As I say, we'll talk again after the first of the year. So Happy New Year up in Minnesota, and thanks for your support in 2013, and we'll keep this up in 2014.
Sounds good. All right, God bless, and I love you guys all, okay?
Back
all right, Merry
here.
Christmas, Aaron Clary. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back with Barry and a few more stories. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're talking tonight about Christmas and war stories. Let me bring Barry back on. Barry, we were talking about the Battle of the Bulge, and I'm sorry, I think I interrupted what you were trying to say, so go ahead and finish that thought. But one quick thing I wanted to say about the Battle of the Bulge before you get back into that point, there was also one very important event, not related to the battle, but related to the Christmas season, and that was the event of Glenn Miller, the great musician who was lost over the English Channel, and he was on his way to Paris to perform for some of the troops. They were having this big Christmas party to some degree, a reflection of how confident we felt about the state of the war, this big party in Paris that they were having, and Glenn Miller was lost on the way to that party. So I just wanted to tie in another little story about Christmas and war stories, Barry.
Yes, it was a great loss. He was one of the great big band leaders. My father, to this day, my father's a World War II veteran, and my father never got rock and roll. Yeah, he didn't understand Elvis. He didn't understand the Beatles. He thought that was all just kind of weird and far out. And to him,
your father
is
not alone
guy.
On that, Barry. Your father is not alone on that conclusion. Okay, I just wanted to add that your father is one of many men of that generation, my father included, who never understood.
Well,
he thought it was just a lot of electric sounds.
And to him, the day that the music died was not when Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper died, you know, with Richie Valley. To him, the day the music died was when Glenn Miller crashed, you know, was shot down over the English Channel.
Right, and just for that, in one day we'll do a show about Glenn Miller because, you know, he was flying from London. My good friend Bill Katz of Urgent Agenda, with whom I do a show on Sundays, is a huge fan of Glenn Miller and knows a great deal about the story. But the theory, the most adopted or accepted theory, is that he was flying in a small aircraft from London to Paris, and he was actually hit by friendly fire, that there were some British bombers coming back to London, and as it is customary, they dropped some of the bombs that they didn't use, and apparently that's how they hit the plane. That's the theory that most people seem to believe, Barry. I mean, that's the one that seems to be most accepted. Nobody knows for sure, but that's the one most accepted, Barry.
Yeah, my father would have said he was shot down accidentally. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, anyway, let me get it back to Leslie. We've got World War II, we got World War I, and I think we've got Vietnam we're going to cover as well. So let me give it back to Leslie.
Well, we'll try and get through the Battle of the Bulge at least. You set up the battlefield, but who are the great personalities involved in this particular battle on either side?
Well, I mean, first of all, Hitler aside, the German commanders were von Rundstedt, who is overall commander of the Western Front. And this is an old line Prussian general staff officer who is largely ignored throughout the war as far as his advice goes by Hitler. He's a very conventional officer for the most part. But the more dynamic officers, the ones who are the more frontline commanders, were Model, Field Marshal Model, who was Hitler's fireman. He was a guy that always was stuck in there when there was a crisis. A man of moderate ability. Hitler thought way more of Model than the other generals thought of him. Sepp Dietrich, who commanded the 6th Panzer Army, and who had been one of the great SS battle commanders of World War II. And probably the most infamous and important of all the officers in the Battle of the Bulge was on the German side, was a fellow by the name of Joachim Piper. Now, Piper is commander of the Spearhead Unit. If you all saw that great movie of the 60s called The Battle of the Bulge, Robert Shaw,
right.
Who most famous for Jaws, the movie Jaws, played the equivalent of Piper. He plays a guy named Hauser, but he really is Piper. And Piper is a lieutenant colonel commanding the Spearhead Regiment. And in Russia, he'd earned a reputation as a very aggressive commander. He was called the Blowtorch. He just blew through the Russians like a blowtorch. And Piper commands the 1st SS Panzer Regiment of the 1st SS Panzer Division. Yeah, this is the premier division of the German Army. And it, by the way, it's equipped with the best and the newest equipment the Germans have, which is way better, you know, by light years than anything the Allies have, including the King Tiger tank and the infantry armed with STG 44 assault rifles, the prototype to all assault rifles. In fact, it's in some ways the ancestor of the AK-47. These guys are superbly equipped, and their job is to break through in the north and capture the supply depots full of fuel that they need to continue the offensive all the way to the channel, the English Channel at Antwerp. And to cross, in the shorter term, to cross the Meuse River by capturing the bridges before the Americans and the British can destroy them. So Joachim Piper, that's his mission. He's a spearhead.
And how about on the other side?
On the Allied side. Well, the Allied side, there's lots of small unit commanders who have been lost to history for the most part, unless you're a scholar, who fought great little small unit actions. But the main character on the Allied side is Patton. George Patton, and he is the most aggressive commander in the Allied side of World War II. Anybody who's seen the movie Patton knows exactly, you know, what I'm talking about. He was the commander of the Third Army. He was south of the Bulge. It's called the Bulge, by the way, because the Ardennes Defensive, which the Germans call Watch on the Rhine. That was named at the Operation Watch on the Rhine. We call it the Battle of the Bulge because the German offensive created a bulge in the Allied lines. They pushed the Allied lines back in the center. And Patton was the main guy responsible for counterattacking from the south with Third Army, which he, by the way, turned on a dime. It was attacking into the Saar region. And within a week, they were all driving north to cut off the German forces driving into the bulge, which was really an amazing feat of military operation. And just shows you how adept his staff work really was at Third Army. And Patton is the supreme armored commander of the Western forces. He's probably the best cavalry commander, if you consider cavalry being mobile, whether it's with tanks or horses. He's the supreme cavalry commander of U.S. history, only possibly rivaled by a Confederate commander of the Civil War named Nathan Bedford Forrest. Those are probably two greatest cavalry commanders. So that's the Allied command during the Battle of the Bulge.
Okay. Now, how did the offensive begin on the German effort? And actually, it's kind of interesting because they had special operations force, the Germans did, that was created specifically for this mission. So why don't you set it up for us?
Well, yeah, let's talk about special operations first. The Germans need a surprise, and they need to achieve their timetable rapidly before they ran out of fuel and before the weather cleared. So they had special operations units tasked to do two things. One was to capture the bridges in advance of their spearheads over the various rivers of the Ardennes, particularly the Or River to the east and then the Meuse River to the west. And to do that, they had actually taken, hand-picked a commando unit of English-speaking Germans. This was a unit that was formed by a guy by the name of Otto Skorzeny. He is Hitler's commando. He's the guy that rescued Mussolini when Mussolini was temporarily overthrown and imprisoned on a mountaintop in Italy in the Alps. And Skorzeny and commandos, Nazi commandos, landed on the mountaintop in gliders. He's Hitler's favorite guy. And in fact, you'll find this of interest, Silvio, because after the war, he goes to South America, where he basically becomes Juan Perón's head of security.
No, really?
He did. In fact, he formed the ODESA, which was the Organization for the Defense of Escaped SS War Criminals, essentially, and spirited many of them out of Germany. But he put the Peronistas in power in Argentina.
Wow. Well, that is interesting. I didn't know that. Thanks for that info.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I thought you'd find that of interest. Yeah,
I think so, yes.
He's called Scarface, and he basically trains this English-speaking battalion and uniforms them with American equipment, American uniforms, and dresses them mostly as MPs. And there's another unit, which he commands, which is all equipped with American equipment, you know, Sherman tanks and Jeeps and so on. And they actually will lead the German forces across the Or River in the initial days of the offensive so that American forces will be confused and think they're, you know, they're Allied forces retreating and instead of German spearheads advancing. And these MPs, these trains, will parachute behind American lines, and they'll secure bridges, they will change road signs, they'll direct traffic in the wrong directions, they'll create traffic jams deliberately behind Allied lines so that, you know, we can't get up to the front, and just basically, you know, sow mischief in advance of the German offensive.
Interesting. One quick question, Barry, about the Battle of the Bulge, that movie that you talk about. I guess it came out in the late 50s or 60s. I don't remember, but I saw that movie with our sons a few years ago when they were younger. They were doing a World War II project, and so we watched that movie as well as other movies. How good is that movie in your opinion? Or how I shouldn't
good.
Say how I wouldn't say how good, but I mean how true. Not
how
good.
Accurate.
I mean they're all good, but I mean how true is it?
It's pretty good. It's pretty accurate.
Okay.
It only shows the advance in the north. It focuses on the efforts of the 6th Panzer under 6th Panzer Army, and particularly the SS under Piper, who again is played by Robert Shaw under a different name. And it focuses on the commando operations I'm talking about. So in that respect, it's good. It completely ignores the efforts in the south where the 101st Airborne got forwarded up at Bastogne and stymied the entire German advance in the southern part of the Ardennes. The Ardennes, basically, there were two spearheads the Germans had. One was the 6th Army in the north, 6th Panzer Army, under Sepp Dietrich, the SS commander. And then in the south, there was Model's 5th Army. And so these two different armies were advancing, and the southern pincher of the advance got stopped at Bastogne by the 101st Screaming Eagles at Bastogne. So that's ignored in the movie. But beyond that, it's pretty good. They used M60 tanks instead of Tigers, you know, and that's a minor complaint. But if you don't mind the fact that the equipment is not exactly right, it's a pretty good movie. Pretty accurate.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a great movie to watch with three boys who were interested, you know, in learning about World War II. This was, a few years back. Leslie, we've got about 5 minutes, guys. It's a great topic, but we've got about 5 minutes. I just wanted to take this in any direction you want to take it, Leslie.
Yeah, I figured we could wrap up the Battle of Bulge, and we have plenty of material for next year.
I think so, yes. So let's go ahead and wrap up the Battle of the Bulge, Barry. And I do want to say one quick thing about Vietnam in December 72. So go ahead and finish the battle.
Okay. Well, the battle begins with Germans having enormous success initially in catching, you know, the Allies completely by surprise. The audience should understand that the Battle of the Bulge becomes the biggest single battle of World War II for the Allies, for the Americans anyway. It's dwarfed by some of the Eastern Front battles, but it's the biggest battle the Americans fight in Europe. And it results in the Germans pushing deep into Allied lines, but eventually, within a matter of days, by the 23rd of December, the battle begins on the 16th of December. And by the 23rd, Piper's spearhead units are reaching the Meuse River, which is the main obstacle between the Germans and breaking free into open country and advancing beyond that through Belgium and into the English Channel to Antwerp, and thus cutting the Allies in two. Unfortunately, when he arrives there at the Meuse River, he's run out of fuel. And that's the problem. The Germans just don't have enough gas. And literally, by the 23rd, Piper's spearhead units have to abandon their tanks and walk backwards, back east, towards the German lines because their tanks are dead. They're at a standstill. And that allows the Allies to gain the initiative. And from then on, the Battle Bulge for the next month is simply the Allies, particularly Patton. Montgomery is notably absent. And slow to react. I don't think Montgomery was ever a very good commander, but certainly in the Battle of the Bulge, he did nothing to contribute to Allied victory. It was strictly Patton who closed the gap, and Hodges from the north with First Army, and they slowly just beat the Germans back, and. You know, the main thing about the Battle of the Bulge was a lot of prisoners were taken on both sides. Casualties were roughly equal on both sides, but it was the last hurrah for the Wehrmacht in the West. From then on, from December 1944 through the rest of the war, which will last until April of 45, Germany is on the defensive and never again regains its footing and is able to launch another offensive.
Yeah, I think, and by the way, the movie really depicts this whole thing about running out of fuel. I thought that was a very interesting part of the movie. Leslie, let me get in a quick word about Vietnam because that was in 1972, and I remember that particular incident, and that was the Christmas bombing, and that had to do, Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, but that had to do with the fact that Nixon said, okay, if you guys don't want to negotiate, I'm just going to bomb I'm going to bomb you pretty hard. He did. And the North Vietnamese came back to the table, and we were able to sign the treaty that ended that war. Is that pretty close to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's Operation Husky. I'm sorry, Linebacker. Operation Linebacker 2 is the operation you're talking about. We basically bombed from, I think it was the 18th, so it might have been the 17th of December through Christmas. It came to be known as the Christmas bombing, but it actually began earlier. And we made hundreds, I think it was a total of 800 some sorties by B-52s, and over 1,000 sorties by lesser tactical aircraft, and just crumbled the infrastructure of North Vietnam, you know, bridges, roads, dams, you name it, harbors, and destroyed their economy and forced them. And by the way, they had been just as stubborn as the North Koreans had been during the Korean War in negotiating anything. And all we wanted in the Vietnam War, our only goal was basically the North to acknowledge that there was a two-state solution, that basically there would be a democratic state in the South and a communist state in the North. And they would never acknowledge that. Ho Chi Minh would never give in to that. And at the end of, by January, by the end of the Christmas bombing, they came back to the tables and they basically surrendered. They negotiated and gave us everything we wanted in order to stop that bombing.
Right. And I remember reading, whether it was John McCain or one of the other POWs, saying that when they saw the Christmas bombing, they knew they were going home pretty soon. They said because they had never really seen bombing like the Christmas bombing. I mean, we had many, many bombing missions before. But the Christmas bombing of 1972 was so rough and so precise, and we really hit them very hard. And as I say, some of the POWs were cheering, saying, hey, we're going home soon. If that's what they're doing, we're going home very soon, Barry. That, I remember reading that.
Well, and it should be remembered that the Vietnam War, though it most people think of it as a loss for us because North Vietnam ended up taking over South Vietnam, the in 1973, 74, we were able to pull our troops out of Vietnam with a peace treaty that on paper guaranteed the independence of South Vietnam. It was only after American forces had basically ended the war and left Vietnam that North Vietnam, a year later, in 1975, began another offensive against the South. Of course, by this point, Watergate had come along and kicked Nixon out of office. Nixon had to resign because of Watergate. And Gerald Ford, his replacement, was a weak president, and the Democrats who controlled Congress refused to resupply South Vietnam with needed material to continue to defend themselves, as we were supposed to, according to the Paris Peace Accords.
Right.
And North Vietnam was able to win the war at that point after we had left. So we essentially won the Vietnam War, and it was lost afterwards once the United States decided not to get back involved.
That's right, and that happened in May of 1975 when Saigon finally collapsed. Well, Leslie, let me end tonight by wishing both of you a very, very Merry Christmas. Leslie, if you would like to have a message for our listeners, both of you, and then we'll have to wrap it up. So, Leslie, you first.
Well, I think I will tell your listeners to party hard, just enjoy family, because we're going to have a lot of work to do in 2014. So,
yes,
enjoy the end of the year, but be prepared to go four on the floor after January 1st.
That's exactly right. And Barry, what is your Christmas message?
I just want to speak out to the serving members of the military, like your son, for instance, Silvio.
Thank you.
And wish them a very Merry Christmas and God blessings on them for their service to our country.
Go ahead.
I would say there's a bit of a lull here between wars. There's always going to be another war, but we seem to be at a moment here where things are winding down, and it's a great moment for all of our service members to be with their families and enjoy the Christmas season.
That's right. And you've had personal experience with this yourself in your own service, and you know how important family is at times like this. Well, I think both of you, your messages are both very inspiring. Leslie wants us to get back to work in 2014, party and get back to work in 2014. And Barry, your message about the troops is very inspiring. On a personal level, I want to wish both of you a very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year, and we'll be back with another war story sometime in 2014, Barry. You've been a great friend and a wonderful person to have on the show, and Leslie, you've been tremendous, and both of you have done, I mean, I'm so happy that we've done these shows, and I look forward to do a lot more next year, Leslie.
Well, we're really blessed to have you as a friend, and thank you for allowing us to borrow your soapbox on Thursday nights to share different stories and different perspectives and featuring a lot of Barry's great military history.
Well, thank you so much, guys. Merry Christmas to you both, and Merry Christmas to the audience. And tonight, we normally leave you with Leslie's song about Egypt, but tonight, because of the holidays, we're going to leave you with a Christmas carol. So good night, everybody. Merry Christmas, Leslie. Merry Christmas, Barry. And we will talk to you soon. Okay, here we go. Merry Christmas, everybody. Good night. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.